First, before we get into the actual content of the episode, which, assuming that you actually read the title, we are going to be talking about the Doppler effect. But before we get into that, I'd just like to tell you guys something very interesting, I guess. Pretty interesting because 33% of the United States population has already had it. And is 67% is about to have it again, or is about to, has yet to have it. I got my first dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine today. Actually, only about 3 hours ago. Actually, I was sitting in the monitoring room 3 hours ago to the point, because I had to be there until 4:42 Central Time, and I'm currently making this episode at 7:33 Central Time. That's, of course, PM, because I do not wake up any earlier than 7:10 in the morning, because who wakes up earlier than 7:10? Everyone, but not me. All I can say is that I feel fine. I'm also 16, though, so I'm about as young as it gets for the vaccine. But I feel fine. I'm not having any problems. I was a little tired right after getting it, but generally, for the most part, I had a little bit of a sore throat, but, like, for the most part, I have almost no feelings at all. Like, it is perfectly fine. And, of course, it hurts where I got the shot, because that's obviously what's going to happen. But all I can say is I highly recommend that you get vaccinated. I don't know what your situation may be because I don't know you personally. But I do very much wish that you can get vaccinated because it really, really will save us from this annoying pandemic. Like, seriously, you can believe whatever you want about whether it kills people or not, but you're not going to be able to stop wearing masks unless we can get enough people vaccinated. So you might as well just get vaccinated because it will help. I can say, though, that the side effects may be annoying. I only know one person who has had significant side effects, and actually, she's just as old as I am. It was one of my friends, and they had side effects, like just typical flu side effects. And they're not bad, but they can be annoying, I guess. It's more like a cold after you get the vaccine. You should expect some symptoms, especially after the second dose. But of course, I still highly recommend it because the cons always never outweigh the benefits in this situation. They never the benefits always outweigh the cons in this situation. So yeah, but anyways, let's get to this episode, because the episode is not on vaccines, unfortunately, but rather on the Doppler effect, which is just as interesting of a topic, but still, it's not vaccines. I mean, vaccines have been on top of everything recently, but yeah, let's get into this. So for 500 years, astronomers and amateurs alike have gazed into the cosmos with their own telescopes, their binoculars, and their eyes. Recently, telescopes and their mirrors have become advanced enough that it has become possible to discern the nebulae and the galaxies with spectacular detail. Us humans, being as naturally curious as we are, chose to search for the most distant and most profound stars and galaxies with the new telescopes we created. When gazing into the deep expanse of the universe and finding the distant quasars and galaxies, I just had to say quasars, we notice a particular feature that is commonplace no matter where we look. The further away the galaxy or deep object is, the redder or the longer wavelength the object appears. It seems that a galaxy like the Andromeda Galaxy is far less red than a comparable galaxy that is 1.6 billion light years away. Now, granted, the Andromeda Galaxy is also moving towards us and not away from us, but still. This feature was once noticed by the astrophysicist Edwin Hubble, among many others preceding him, a physicist that will be spoken of frequently in this chapter. Episode, who found that this reddening paradigm was more profound the further one looked out into the universe. So a galaxy 100 million light years away will appear less redshifted, redshifted is just the term, than a galaxy 2 billion light years away. Even if the two galaxies have the exact same compositions, are literally the exact same galaxy in terms of age, composition, size, all that. This redshifting determined for Hubble that the universe was expanding, and he proved his findings through what is known as the Doppler effect, which is the phenomenon that creates the redshifting Hubble used to determine that the universe was expanding. In this chapter or episode, we will discuss the Doppler effect, how it occurs, and what it represents. For one of the first times ever, we are venturing into classical mechanics. To understand the Doppler effect, we must venture into classical physics. To understand every concept in physics, though, you, whether classical or not, you really kind of need to know classical physics. It is not only important, but pretty much required. I remember watching a video by Michio Kaku. You might know that video I'm talking about when you hear what I said. He spoke of how they often fail their physics, their entry-level physics majors, because when they get into the entering level, they have to take Physics 1. They have to take the simple, basic classical physics that Newton discovered himself many centuries ago, not many, but centuries ago, and often they will have almost no understanding of it because they learn the difficult stuff first. Because the difficult stuff is more fun to learn because it's more difficult to learn. But the problem with that is that you don't have a background in physics, and you need a background in physics to be able to understand the more difficult physical topics. Now, granted, quantum mechanics and classical mechanics are nowhere near similar, and actually the whole problem is that they're not similar, at least in our current understanding of both, but still, it's advisable that you understand physics before you get into quantum physics. The Doppler effect was first hypothesized by Austrian physicist Christian Doppler in 1842. His hypothesis was tested with sound waves by the Dutch meteorologist. We've never said that before, but I love weather, so I'm very happy that there's a meteorologist on here. His name was Buys Ballot. I believe that is correct, in 1845. Ballot concluded that the sound waves had pitches higher than the emitted frequencies when the source of the sound was approaching him. Think of how cars beep as they pass you, for an example. As they are approaching you, their pitches seem far greater than their pitches when they are moving away from you. So when they pass you, their pitches are much greater. Boom. And as they move past you, you hear the sound going down, the pitch going down, and boom, there you go. And when the source of the sound was moving away from them, the frequencies and pitches of the sound were both lesser than that of the emitted frequency pitch. The Doppler effect was first proven with sound, but it applied not only to sound, but to many other topics and phenomena. In 1848, the French physicist Hippolyte, I'm almost positive that I said that wrong, Fizeau discovered the Doppler effect occurring with electromagnetic waves. On a side note, Fizeau was one of the measurers of the speed of light that was not discussed in the last chapter or last episode. He measured it to be 313,000 kilometers per second, which is, like, I think it's like 13,507.542 kilometers per second, greater than the currently accepted speed of light. Fizeau discovered the same relationship with the Doppler effect occurring with photons, where wavelengths and frequencies increased and decreased relative to the velocity of the emitting object relative to the observer. The Doppler effect came to be a widely accepted and verified subject within 6 years of its hypothesis, unlike many newer, harder to verify hypotheses in physics. That often take well over 50 years to truly verify. Supersymmetry was first hypothesized in 1971, and yet it has not even been observed. And it is still pretty cohesive. It's actually somewhat cohesive, but there's no evidence that it exists. But there are reasons for that. Like, the electron decay is very... a superpartner electron does not decay quickly, so CERN is not able to actually see it as well, but granted, it's still not much of a difference. I mean, there's no observational evidence. Granted, there's still no observational evidence of the existence of supersymmetry, but we do have mathematical evidence. But still, it's been 50 years, so that should say something. Its effects would be far more profound as the rise of Hubble and relativity began. Unlike many paradigms in physics, the math in the Doppler effect is quite simplistic. As long as you listen through pre-calculus, but even then I wouldn't say you didn't have much of a problem. So we're going to go through this phenomenon in the way that physics is taught. Mathematically, of course. I would explain the rest of the physics we cover through calculus, but I simply do not know calculus. In a year when I'm making like podcast episode 86 or something, you can expect that I will be including stuff like that specifically, because... Well, first of all, I plan to do it. I mean, I'm already doing calculus, but I don't have any understanding of it. But once I know like what I'm looking at, calculus will be fine. There will be no problem looking at stuff like that. And I'm also taking physics next year, and the thing about physics is that I don't understand it yet. I know a lot. No, I don't. I know very little in quantum mechanics, but that is what I specialize in based on the podcasts. But in terms of classical mechanics, I know nothing. So that is going to be a very interesting class because I've never learned anything like that before. I'm very intrigued and very excited considering it is going to be the class that I follow through on, and meaning the class that establishes my major, essentially. But yeah, so we are going to discuss this through simple mathematics. It's algebra. It's algebra with symbols. The formula in the classical Doppler effect is quite simple. Not simple, simple. The equation is F prime equals V plus V naught. I don't think it's V naught though, because it's actually the velocity of the observer, so it wouldn't necessarily be V naught. Divided by V, divided by V plus the velocity of the observer, or the velocity of the source, times F. So in this equation, F prime refers to the observed frequency or wavelength of the wave. F refers to the actual frequency of the emitter. So like, if the original wavelength of a photon is 296 nanometers, I get it. It's a very, 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 that's UV light, but I think it is. It should be. But at that point, obviously, okay. Like that's the emitted frequency, but maybe it turns out to be 386. Once it reaches the, once it passes through the rest of the inner craziness of the sun and makes it out. But let's get to the rest of it. V refers to the velocity of the waves, so you have the velocity of the waves often in this. VO, the V dash O that I considered F naught or V naught, refers to the velocity of the observer, and V dash S refers, or it's not actually V dash S, it's VS, it's V with a small s kind of slightly below it, refers to the velocity of the source of the wave. They did not explain exactly what terminology was this was for this, but you can assume that it's probably something along those lines. But anyways, because we are physicists in training, we must practice these equations. Let's just picture a simple example, and I guess fret not, for I mo may not understand what I'm learning. And I may be incorrect in my calculations, but from what I've seen, this is exactly what it is. So we're going to give an example. So just imagine a young woman standing on the side of the road, unmoving. In front of her, a person rides his or her bike into the road as a car approaches. The person in the car, seeing the biker, warns the biker by beeping. The biker survives, and so does the driver, but the horn continues as it passes by the woman. Picture that the woman was unmoving and that the driver was traveling 20 meters per second. Was traveling 20 meters per second. The typical frequency of a car horn is 430 hertz, so the car horn will have an initial frequency of 430 hertz. We are going to calculate the increase in frequency of the sound as the beeping car approaches the young woman or the observer. The speed of sound is 343 meters per second, so we can assume that our V, or for velocity of the wave, would be 343 meters per second. If I'm actually calculating this correctly, in the numerator one would plug in 343, because remember that the observer is unmoving, as the woman is unmoving and the speed of sound is 343 meters per second. And in the denominator, one would plug in 343 minus 20, as the velocity of sound is 343 meters per second, and the car is traveling at 20 meters per second towards the woman. Now, in the case that it is traveling away, it would be 343 plus 20, because it'd be doing 343 minus minus 20, and minus minus is always plus. You just have to basically flip one of those minuses to not to vertically, to being vertically. So flip it 90 degrees, and then boom, you got your plus sign. But one must now divide the 343 by 323, at that point obtaining an answer of 1.06191950. Now this answer must be multiplied by the frequency of the sound waves emanating from the car horn in hertz, where the frequency is 430 hertz. When multiplying the answer by 430 hertz, one obtains the answer being that of 456.63 hertz, an increase in frequency due to the Doppler effect. This happens with light as well. The wavelength may get longer, maybe more profound, larger, as redshift occurs. But on the other hand, the frequency increases as blue shifting occurs, because frequency is greater in gamma rays, or energy, you could even say. I mean, technically not necessarily energy, but you know what I mean. Let's now try it the opposite way, though. So the car is traveling away from the young woman at 20 meters per second. In the denominator, it is now 343 plus 20, so 363. If one divides 343 divided by 363, one gets an answer of 0.94490035813. If one multiplies this by the 430 hertz frequency of the car sound waves, car horn sound waves, one obtains the answer of 406.308 5399 hertz. Such an answer indicates that the frequency of the sound waves decrease as the car and horn equals corn recedes from the young woman. As much fun as it was solving physics problems, it is important to understand the concept of the relativistic Doppler effect, which is another thing we're going to be getting into, which is probably the most important part of this episode, in my opinion. So now it is understood that classical mechanics will be left for now. We're going to be getting into calculus, and I'm not going to be doing the calculus. I have attached a million links in the description that will detail all of this so that you can do some research on your own, because I always pride myself in giving you guys as much, basically outreach, or as much, resources, as many resources as possible, because it is very important that you do research yourself, of course. My goal is basically to inspire you to do so, which I'm not a good inspirer, so that shouldn't really be the greatest thing I could be doing. But again, teaching is about inspiring, and my goal here is to inspire you guys into doing research on your own, because it is truly incredible to learn something on your own rather than listening to someone teach it to you. It is amazing to learn something on your own. I promised you that. That is what motivates me to make these episodes. But anyways, the relativistic Doppler effect is simply the lengthening and contracting of the wavelength of light, or the increasing and decreasing of the frequency of light in the observer source directionality speed paradigm that was discussed earlier in this chapter. So, stuff with the car, stuff with the woman, relative to the woman, you know what I mean. The relativistic Doppler effect occurs in three known separate situations. There's the typical Doppler shift, which was discussed earlier in the chapter. The gravitational redshift, that is a very, very common thing that occurs. This is essentially what occurs when light is essentially bent by a massive gravitational source. This is generally how we discover extremely distant objects, including the furthest known star, Icarus. And cosmological expansion redshift, which we will discuss in detail later in this episode. The equations and paradigms of relativistic Doppler shifts do not equate to the typical Doppler shifts, as they include time dilation and special relativity and follow the guidelines of Lorentz symmetry, which we will discuss in a future episode without question. It was discussed in episode 30 as well, so you can always look at that as well, but it was not really discussed in detail. But yeah. In 1912, the American astronomer Vesto Slipher, I might be saying that wrong, first observed the redshift of distant galaxies. So we're going to be getting into cosmological expansion redshift. Upon this discovery, it was purported that galaxies at the time were generally considered spiral nebula, or nebulae, until Hubble discovered that they most definitely were not nebulae, the galaxies that were observed were moving away from the Milky Way. 10 years later, the physicist Alexander Friedman, using Einstein's field equations and Slipher's observations, proposed the first mathematical evidence for the expansion of the universe. Following these proposals of an expanding universe, the astrophysicist, a very well-known one, Edwin Hubble, Hubble Space Telescope, first discovered that those galaxies that were considered distant, redshifted spiral nebulae, are actually distant galaxies, gravitationally independent from the bounds of the Milky Way. After this discovery, he provided observations that confirmed cosmological expansion and cemented the expanding universe as the basis for cosmological physics. And oh yeah, it is definitely the basis for cosmological physics. It is the basis for everything that could possibly happen. It is the basis for dark matter, it is the basis for the fate of the universe, and it is the basis for the creation of the universe. So it is extremely important. Cosmological expansion redshifting is defined as a redshift in the emission lines. Emission lines are wavelengths at which specific elements emit photons of all of the receding and most of the astronomical objects in the universe. Astrophysicists often use these shifts to indicate the recessional velocity or recession velocity of an object. That is a technical term, recession velocity. And in the case of distant galaxies and other objects, the rate of expansion of the universe, which by the way is still very contested, they use this shift. I completely blundered my words. Same thing. Astrophysicists use these shifts to indicate the recession velocity of an object, and in the case of distant galaxies and other objects, obviously it's greater. It's obviously greater in more distant objects. Edwin Hubble, when researching the expansion of the universe, discovered that the recession velocity of a galaxy was greater when the galaxy was further away. He noticed a constant rate of expansion of the universe relative to Earth. This discovery, known as Hubble's constant, indicates a constant rate of cosmological expansion occurring per megaparsec. It changes often, though. The accepted value today is highly scrutinized because different experiments provide wildly, as in 4 to 10% difference, values for the rate of cosmological expansion. But it is believed to be around 73.3 plus or minus 2.5 kilometers per second per megaparsec. If one were to look out 1 megaparsec at a galaxy that is not on a collision course with the Milky Way, M31 is around 0.778 megaparsecs from Earth, but it is heading towards us, so its light is actually blue shifted. But if we were to look at one that's 1 megaparsec away that is not approaching us, through measuring the redshifting of the photons emitted from exactly a megaparsec away from Earth, he or she would find that the object emitting the photons would be receding from Earth at around 73.3 kilometers per second minus or plus or minus 2.5 kilometers per second. I'm going to, for now, abandon the margin of error, but remember that it is profoundly important. Now, being that this is 73.3 kilometers per second per megaparsec, it is important to understand the relative to Earth expansion of the universe increases as further objects are observed. If one were to observe a galaxy a gigaparsec, 1,000 megaparsecs, 1 billion parsecs, or 3.26 billion light years away from Earth, the recession velocity would be far more profound. At a gigaparsec, the object would be receding from Earth at a rate of 73,300 kilometers per second. Going even further out, and notably into a region that profoundly confuses every amateur astronomer alive, imagine a galaxy that is 5 gigaparsecs away from Earth. And yes, it is still possible to see a galaxy this far away, but it is simply different, and we will discuss why it is simply different. This is 16.3 billion light years away from Earth, and being that 5 gigaparsecs are 5,000 megaparsecs, the light emitted from this distant galaxy is receding from Earth at 366,500 kilometers per second. Far, far faster than the speed of light. If you want to see chapter 30, you can see episode 30 for more details on the speed of light. I assume that alarm bells are ringing as loudly as the car horn discussed earlier in the chapter. I assume that those are ringing in your head profoundly, so it is important and imperative that both the fact that some galaxies have greater light year distance values than the age of the universe, and the fact that the recession velocity of this galaxy is greater than the speed of light be discussed. First, the fact that the distance of the most distant objects like Icarus, a star 14 billion light years away from Earth, and other objects that are as distant as 32 billion light years away is simply baffling. How is it possible that we can see light from objects further than 13.8 billion light years away? Again, the expansion of the universe is important here. Think of a galaxy 13.4 billion light years away right now. Right from the light that we're seeing from it. This is based on the spot the light traveled from. And this is a real galaxy known as GN-Z11. This galaxy emitted its light at a distance of 13.4 billion light years 13.4 billion years ago. Due to cosmological expansion, the galaxy is moving further and further away from us. In the 13.4 billion years since the galaxy 13.4 light years away, 13.4 billion light years away emitted the light, due to the expansion of the universe, its proper distance, which proper distance accounts for cosmological expansion, and distance based on the distant light travel does not. It is now 31.96 billion light years away, 32 billion light years away, basically. So it's the expansion of the universe makes things further away. That's basically what it is. The next conflict is the fact that it seems as if the universe is expanding faster than the speed of light. How is that possible? We discussed this briefly in episode 30, but I think it should be discussed a little bit more. Does that not violate the principle of special relativity and the speed of limit of the universe? No, it does not violate special relativity, and no, it does not violate the speed limit of the universe. The speed of light is the speed at which light travels in a vacuum or in space-time. Considering the fact that the universe is not necessarily within space-time, but rather it's space-time itself, it is not restricted to the speed of light. It can travel as fast as it wishes, though it is not a conscious being, of course, and will not be restricted to C, or the speed of light, or episode 30. But yeah, so that's basically why it happened in that way. It is as that is. It is an obvious fact that the universe is expanding and that its rate of expansion is increasing. As the universe continues to expand and continues to, and of course, as the universe continues to expand and continues to increase its expansion rate, redshifting will become even more profound. Cosmological expansion will undoubtedly continue as a result of the significant amount of dark matter and energy, which comprise 95% of the mass in the universe. That is believed to accelerate expansion and increase the distances between the galaxies. Eventually, cosmological expansion may increase to a rate greater than that of the speed of light per megaparsec, and as a result, the light emitted from any region of megaparsec or further away will not ever reach the point of the observer. The redshifting resulting from cosmological expansion will not exist anymore in the rapidly expanding universe. It'll still exist, but it won't be the same. And the only objects visible to the observers in these unreachable independent galaxies will be the very stars and nebulae that comprise their own galaxy. It is generally accepted that the universe will continue to expand forever in a doctrine known as the heat death. It's quite literally the death of heat in the universe, but not anything along the lines from death from excessive heat. The heat death theory purports that in this universe in which dark matter and energy continue to foment and accelerate undying cosmological expansion, the resulting expansion evolves the universe into a state of thermodynamic equilibrium. In the second law of thermodynamics, all closed systems eventually reach thermodynamic equilibrium, where entropy is greatest, and when entropy is greatest, nothing can be performed to increase entropy, so there you go. At the end of work is basically what they mean. And that's literally what I mean. This equilibrium makes it impossible for there to be thermodynamic free energy, which is the maximum amount of work that can be performed by a thermodynamic system under a constant temperature in the universe, meaning that entropy can no longer be increased. Thermodynamic equilibrium. As a result, nothing can then perform work, so no more processes occur within the universe, and thus the universe is as good as dead. Its infinitely grand eyes are now closed. Allusion. This chapter was meant to be based entirely on the Doppler effect, but it most certainly did not pertain merely to the topic. Electromagnetic Doppler effects and relativistic Doppler effects led this episode into the dangerous waters of cosmological expansion and the ultimate fate of the universe, both of which are heavily, heavily disputed. There will undoubtedly be many more chapters pertaining to this topic, specifically pertaining to physical cosmology, where we investigate the brilliant and brilliantly disputed wonders of the universe. Our path away from ignorance is only beginning, and as we lead into the next chapter of human discovery, it is important to know that our ignorance will be only further accentuated as we learn more. in the 31 chapters, episodes, or chapters, as well as you may want to say, whatever you want, wish to say, I've written on the universe, I've discovered just how insanely naive I am. I've always been a very egotistical person, but I guess I never realized just how ignorant and naive I was as a young human being without any prior knowledge in many topics, because yet I have not lived long enough to understand them. 31 chapters of 70,000 literally words, and I feel like I knew more before I started writing these. And in a way, it is kind of true, because actually I didn't know more, I just thought I knew more before. Ignorance is bliss. Google wrote that for me. It is often said that the more one knows, the more one knows they do not know, and the more they do not know, they do not know. That quote is exact and obvious, of course. If you've spent a long time trying to learn stuff, you'll realize that there's a lot more that you need to learn. In proper schooling, you generally don't get that same feeling. You kind of get a prideful, like, I know what I'm doing kind of feeling if you are able to understand content. But the problem with that is that you don't know everything. There's so much you have yet to learn. There's so much that could be learned on top of that. And that's one reason why, for all those who are in school right now, I would just say do extra research based on the stuff that you learn in school. It is quite profound. You will learn a ton by going further. Continue to learn, my friends. That is basically what we're here to do. But anyways, thank you all for listening, and as always, have a good morning, afternoon, evening, and night. Again, new thing, if you would like to support the podcast, please click the link in the description of my channel, where you can support the channel. I have 12 years of college ahead of me, and it would be nice to afford college unlike most of my peers. And I mean, I'm literally the only one that I think will actually be able to save for college correctly, because I actually have a little bit of savings, but again, I'm going to college for 12 years, so I'm going to need as much money as possible. 1 cent is perfect. I will take 1 cent. 1 cent is something to be proud of. I'll be like, first donation, woohoo. That's fine by me. But anyways, take care and stay curious.